Well, having been Dr. Epperle's roommate, I know some things about him that I can't tell you. Now, he was a great roommate, and one thing, I like a whole lot of things about Bruce Epperle. One, he's a fine mind. He noted that together we had published something like 25 works. Well, I didn't want to say to him, but Bruce, 20 of them were yours. He's really immensely productive, and something that I like about Bruce is he wants to speak to the situation of the church and real people in a real world. He can be highly academic if you want him to, but he's interested in whole people, and I am too. And I knew that from the first moment that I met him. He likes dogs. I had a dog, and Bruce was a really good friend to my dog too, Old Ed. I also want to say that it's really great to be here with the Gregorys. And I got a chance to visit with them before this talk. And I realized that on this very row here, there are people with so much more experience than I have, and probably so much more wisdom than I have, including wisdom concerning China. So I'd like to change the topic of my lecture, if that's all right. But it's really an honor to be here in your presence. Actually, all five of you there. Honduras, China and Japan, China. Even in China, after the revolution in 49, spent a couple of years there. What a world they have seen. April, where are you, if you're here? Well, see, that's typical. Because she's doing all the work, and she has made it a pleasure for me to come here. And Dr. Potterfeld, thank you so much. It's good to meet you, the president. And we were in Claremont as well. All right, here we go. I earn my living as a college teacher teaching the world's religions. And for many years, I will begin a class like this. I'll say, let's imagine that we are the whole of the world. What percentage of us would be Christian? What percentage Muslim? What percentage Jewish? Here's what it would look like. About 30% of the world would define itself as Christian. Now, the majority of those live in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. So today, many people speak of Christianity as a post-Western religion. It began in the West, but it's now in its post-Western phase. And some of you actually were fairly instrumental in helping Christianity become a post-Western tradition. About 20% of you would be Muslim, 18 to 20%. It is said, I don't know, that you're the fastest growing religion in the world by virtue of birth rates. So I think that would mean that 50% of the world is either Christian or Muslim. That's how important that dialogue is. Now, only one of you could be Jewish, not because you're not important, but because numerically, Jews represent less than 0.5% of the world's population. But you put those three traditions together, Judaism, which is kind of the parent religion, Christianity, which began as an offshoot of Judaism, and Islam, which is also in that lineage, and you've got what we call the Abrahamic religious traditions. Now, about four of you could be Buddhist. Buddhism constitutes about 6% of the world's population. So I think that'd be about four of you. Interestingly enough, Buddhism is having a marked impact in the United States and in portions of Western Europe. People who are disaffected with the Abrahamic religious traditions are drawn to something in Buddhism that speaks to their hearts. It offers an opportunity to listen. It can seem less aggressive. it can seem, maybe in a romanticized way, gentler. Now, that's not necessarily true, but it can seem that way. About 12% of you would be Hindu. Most of you would live in India, but not all in India. And I would begin that way, and then in my class, I'd say, what do we do with China? Is China a religious nation? Well, I know that my textbooks would have chapters on Confucianism and chapters on Taoism and chapters on Chinese Buddhism. So I know that according to my textbooks, there's something called religion in China. And I know there's Christianity in China, too. Estimates are that it's anywhere from 8 to 12% of the population in China. But China's a hard one. Because if you actually go to China and you look for something called religion, as you might read about it in the textbooks, it's kind of hard to see. And that paves the way for my discussion today. I happen to have done a whole lot of work in interreligious dialogue, particularly with Buddhism. So sometimes if people ask me, what are you? I say, I'm a Christian influenced by Buddhism. And part of that is because I was the English teacher for a Zen Buddhist priest from Japan many, many years ago for one full year. We got to know each other real well. And I began to think that he knew some things I didn't know. That there was wisdom in his life, in his tradition, that I lacked. And if God is a source of wisdom, then surely God had been present in his life too. Quite independently of any mediation by me, or for that matter, by Christianity. So I myself assume that God is like a wind that blows throughout the whole of this world. And yes, God blows onto the faces of the lives of Christians, but yes, God can blow on the faces of Jews. Yes, God, the gentle wind can blow in the faces of Muslims. As a Christian, I say, wherever there's wisdom and compassion, there God is present. Thus named or not. And actually, thus believed in or not. I don't think as Christians we are compelled to say only those who believe in God know God. People can experience a gentle wind but not have a name for the wind. So I trust that the living spirit of God, the breathing of God, the breath of God, has of course been at work in China before the Christians got there. But what about modern China? Well, this is where my own life has been turned around in the past 5 years. Several years ago, I was at a conference in Claremont, California on interreligious dialogue. We were sitting at a round table, and I think our discussion was how to have interreligious dialogue. And there was a Jew, and there was a Hindu, and there was a Muslim, and there were some Christians, and there was a man from China. And we began the conversation by introducing ourselves. So I said, I'm Jay McDaniel, and I'm a Christian. Person next to me said, I'm so-and-so, and I'm Jewish. Person next to me said, on the other side, I'm so-and-so, and I'm Muslim. Person here said, I'm so-and-so, and I'm Hindu. And then we got to the man from China. He said, my name is Joho Wong, and I'm 20% Confucian, 20% Taoist, 20% Buddhist, 20% Marxist, and 20% Christian. I think that adds up. I remember when he said that. You know, when I had my Western frame of reference, no, you can't be 20% Christian, you have to be 100%. I think you're supposed to be 100% Christian. And 20% Marxist, and also 20% Taoist. But you know, the more I thought about it, the more I realized I'm those percentages too. If you really look at what shapes anybody, any of us, we're shaped by many different sources of wisdom. For example, I grew up in Texas, and there's a river that I love, the Guadalupe River in the hill country of Texas. I think that I'm shaped by that river. And I grew up with dogs, and I love animals. If I were just honest, I'd say I'm shaped by their beauty. And I was the English teacher for a Zen Buddhist priest. Let me be honest. He changed me. I found something in him that I lacked. So I began to realize that I'm a hybrid. We're all hybrids. We are all nourished by different lineages. So then I began to wonder, maybe one of the prophetic witnesses from China, maybe, is the simple idea that you can be nourished by multiple sources of wisdom, whether they're called religions or cultural traditions or whatever. And what is it like to be a Christian who honors the many sources of wisdom? So I began to realize I've got something to learn from at least Chinese that think like that. And that was about the time that that man called me and he said, Jay, I want you to start going over to China. We got to know each other. I want you to start going over to China with me. And I think I've been 7 times in the past 4 years. Process theology, which Bruce mentioned, is now having an impact in China. Not a widespread, not a massive impact, but there are now 17 centers for process studies at various universities in China. And I have gone over for the past 3 summers and taught courses in process thought to Chinese intellectuals, people in departments of economics, education, literature, etc. And all of this was started by this man named Zhou Wang, who was sitting at that table. And he has an interesting story, too. He grew up in the system. He's a member of the party, the Communist Party. He was the editor for the international version of the Chinese Journal of Social Sciences, based in Beijing. He went to Peking University or Beijing University. And he found himself, as the editor of this pretty prestigious journal, getting to read a lot of material from around the world. And he decided that process thought offered hope for China. Number one, it had a scientific aspect to it. And the Chinese today want to be scientific. Number two, its vision talked about the interconnectedness of everything and harmony. That sounds a little Chinese. So he began to think that this movement, the process movement, might have a hearing in China and might be able to kind of help Chinese today with the spiritual hunger that they feel, which they do. So I've been going over with Wang Zhehe a lot and just making friends with Chinese and talking about this theological tradition. But the first time that I went, maybe 4 years ago, I was going to a conference on process thought and Marxism. And I didn't know much about what I was going to find, but I remember getting there. It was in Harbin, China, and my host picked me up and took me to this dormitory and said, this is where you'll be staying. We're glad you're here. There were the flowers and the bananas and things like that. And then I sat down and I said, okay, here I am in China. And about that time, knock on the door. About 6 people came in and they said, are you Dr. McDaniel? Yes. Would you mind giving a talk tonight at 7 o'clock? And I said, they said, didn't Zhehe tell you? He had forgotten to mention this. And I said, on what? And they said, whatever you're going to talk about at that conference. Well, I'm going to talk about environmentalism. But that's fine. come talk about environmentalism. So I'd been in China about 2 hours, and there I was to give this talk. So I went to this auditorium, and there were about, I think there were probably about 250 people there, mostly college students. I think they were there because they wanted to hear me speak in English and practice their English. I don't think they had this burning desire to hear a Westerner talk about environmentalism, but they did have a burning desire to brush up on their English, and I think that's why they were there. But I gave the talk, had a translator, gave the talk, and at the end of the talk they said, are there any questions? Time for discussion. And a student sitting about right there raised his hand, and he said, Dr. McDaniel, yes, you teach religion, is that right? Yes. Then I have a question. What is the purpose of life? And it was that straightforward. And by the way, you know, if you're in the United States and you get asked that question by a college junior or a college senior, it's a kind of cynical question sometimes. Okay, smarty pants, yeah, you know about religion. All right, yeah, what's the purpose of life? The tone was not like that at all. It was an honest, sincere question. This person was saying, I'm looking for purpose in my life. What do you think it is? Well, as a theologian, I thought, oh, this is my chance. So has any of you ever heard of D'Arte Azzola, the German writer? Anyway, I think a lot of people say the purpose of life is to love and be loved. I knew I just had 1 minute. So I said, I think the purpose of life is to love and be loved. And I hoped that that would just overwhelm him. He didn't like that answer. I found out later that it got translated, that love got translated into romantic love. So to have a romantic relationship, that's the purpose of life. So I understand. But afterwards, I talked to my translator and I said, I was surprised by that question because it was so honest and so genuine. And she said, I'm not surprised at all. She said, I think a lot of Chinese are asking that question. Because it's a new China. In some ways, the dominant religion of China today is consumerism. Is there life past cell phones? Is there meaning to life beyond the legitimate concern, can I get a job? I really want to know, he was saying, what do you think? Well, you put those two stories together, what is the purpose of life? And I'm 20% Buddhist, 20% Taoist, 20% Confucian. You put those two stories together, and you can understand at least why I am hooked on China. Because we all know that we now live in a post-American world. If we don't know it yet, we will soon know it. But you know Shakespeare's metaphor, all the world's a stage and the men and women merely players. Well, let's be honest. It's no longer America's century. America is not necessarily at center stage. There are multiple partners, multiple characters at center stage. China, India, Iran, the United States. Brazil. So people speak of the world that we now live in as a multipolar world with many poles, many centers of gravity, and increasingly none overriding the others. And sometimes they live in tension, and sometimes they live in harmony. So what is needed among Americans? Well, I think we have to develop a new kind of patriotism. Call it a postmodern patriotism. We can love what's best about our country, We can be honest about what's worse. And we can honor and learn from the people of other cultural traditions. We're partners on a single stage. Let 1,000 flowers bloom. But what about Christians? I'm not just an American. I think I'm a Christian. I want to be a Christian. I want to follow Christ. What does that mean in a multipolar world? What does that mean in regard to China? What can Christians learn from China? What's the prophetic witness of China to Christians? And that's why I chose that topic today. So I want to name, I think I've got 5 lessons I think we Christians can learn from China and Chinese people today. The first one I've really already named. We want to be Christians, but we want to avoid Christianism. And what I mean by Christianism, it's when Christianity itself becomes an ideology, a flag that we cling to, because it orients us toward the wind of God, but we end up worshiping the flag. We end up being more interested in the flag than in the living Spirit of God. And a preoccupation with Christian identity becomes more important than simply being open to the living Spirit of God. You see, so I think that when my friend said, I'm 20% Taoist, 20% Buddhist, 20% Confucian, 20% Marxist, 20% Christian, I think that was God speaking through him. And God was saying to me, don't worship something called Christianity. Be open to the living Spirit of God, but watch out for Christianolatry. Watch out for Christianism. There's a well-known Buddhist writer, some of you I'm sure are familiar with him, Thich Nhat Hanh. And Thich Nhat Hanh sometimes says, I'm a Buddhist with a small b. I think that this Christian, I won't speak for you if you're Christian, this Christian wants to explore the possibility of being a Christian with a small c. It doesn't mean I don't want to follow the Christian path, but it does mean I recognize that the living Spirit of God is more than Christianity. Now, the second thing that I think Christians in America can learn from Chinese, it's a funny kind of lesson. I'm going to call it overcoming unhealthy individualism. Now, I just need to tell you, this past summer I spent 2 months in Harbin, China as the program director for a summer language institute where college students from all over the United States that were really good in Chinese language, the State Department paid for them to go spend 2 months in China taking intermediate and advanced Chinese. And so in some respects, I was with the cream of the crop of Chinese language students in the United States. They had 400 applicants. They accepted 40 students. The 40 students, we got on a plane in Washington, D.C. after being prepped by the State Department, landed in Harbin, China, and there we were. And I lived on the dorm with them, in the same dorm with them. I really love those students, those American students. But the American students, I would compare the American students with the Chinese students who they had hired to be the language companions for the American students. Those Chinese students, they called them Julies. They were teaching assistants. And I noticed that the Julies, they sometimes seemed to have a little more discipline than the American students. They could hear the call of duty. Duty was actually a good word for them. It's my duty. I would say thank you to somebody for helping me. I'd say thank you so much for helping me do this or that. And they'd say, it's my duty. And I'd say, no, I don't want you to say that. I want you to say, because I love you. That's a Christian, you know. I'm not doing it out of duty. I'm doing it out of desire. But then I began to look at that again. Maybe there's something kind of good about being able to relativize your own ego and just plain do what seems to you to be the right thing. Personal preferences aside. And I saw that capacity, and see it all the time, of Chinese to, you might say, surrender personal preferences in service to something more. I would like to tell you a story that will bring that home. I have to watch my clock. While we were in China this past summer, while I was there, I had three students that had to have surgery. One broke his ankle, one broke a collarbone, and one had an appendectomy. And so I spent a lot of time in Chinese hospitals in Harbin, China. And in a Chinese hospital, somebody has to stay overnight with the person and make sure that the meds go through the tubes. And so the question was, who will stay overnight with these American students? Because somebody has to. Now, they weren't going to let me do it, although I suppose I could have insisted, because I'm old. But the question was, should American students do it, or should Chinese students do it? And the Chinese immediately said, we'll do it. We will stay all night, overnight, making sure that this American student is okay, and they did. They said, the one reason we'll do it is it's our duty. But another thing is the American students are studying for language courses, so we want them to be able to study. That's why they're here. No problem. But then the last one, the course was over when a young girl broke her collarbone. So in that last one, the question was, who will stay this time? Who will spend a week in the hospital this time? And I have to admit, it was hard to get an American student to agree to do it. And this was even the case for the one who actually caused the accident. And when the accident first occurred, this person said, of course I'll do it. But when the time came, she came up to me and she said, Dr. McDaniel, I'm so stressed out. This is an emotional time for me. It's been a really hard day. Can you get one of the Chinese students to do it? And when she said that, I saw, oh, I see. Personal comfort, personal preferences, personal desires, trump the call of duty. Now, on the Chinese side, there's something they loved about the American students. The American students were a wild and crazy bunch. Did they like to party? The Chinese students said, they party hard, they study hard. That's great. And we Americans, we were very individualistic. One of my students, really tall guy, white guy, but had the best dreadlocks I think I've ever seen in the history of the universe. Really tall, huge dreadlocks, and a wonderful human being. And he was so cool. He could be himself, and he was spontaneous, and he was kind. And the Chinese students said, that's America. That's America, that spontaneity, that joy of living, that's America. Well, on the last night, I saw one of the Julies who'd spent the night with that girl, and I saw that American boy, and they were standing together, they were talking. My own feeling was, that's the best of each culture. The spontaneity, the joy, the freedom, the vitality, that's something good and beautiful And I saw that the Chinese liked that. But I also saw a capacity to surrender one's personal preferences to something more than yourself. There's something quite beautiful about that. So my feeling is the second prophetic witness of China, and a lot of East Asia for that matter, is to call Americans, call us, call me, and say, there's healthy individuality and there's unhealthy individuality. And if your personal preferences become the Lord and Savior of your life, where you always act on the basis of, does it feel right and does it please me, that's unhealthy individualism. China's a prophetic witness to that. Third, I don't know what to do with socialism. I know that we live in a time, have you noticed that we're having a bit of a financial crisis in our nation? Has anyone noticed this? And then have you just happened to notice that one reason that the government's trying to be very careful in bailing out banks, not to own the bank, because that would be socialism. That's the government playing too important a role. And so when we hear the Chinese say that today we're experimenting with market socialism, combining market realities with socialism, we don't know what to think. Excuse me? Market? Socialism? Aren't those at odds? Well, if they are, the Chinese are sure they're sure working hard at changing that. But what I discovered about the Chinese, there's a sense in which it seems to me that the dream of a classless society, Marx's dream, that no longer strikes the heartstrings of Chinese. I cannot find a Chinese person who says, yay, classless society. Even communism is a bit of a bad word, even in China. But socialism's not. Socialism's not. Well, I think that China is a prophetic witness to us because it invites us to rethink the way we organize our society. And I think that it can help us remember Martin Luther King Jr.'s vision of beloved community. Seems to me that today, and I'll just share this and you tell me what you think. Seems to me that today, we Americans are kind of torn. If we're United States citizens, we're torn between two versions of the American dream. And one, or let's say two dreams. And one of those dreams is rags to riches. What's it mean to be an American? It's to work hard, have some luck, play by the rules, and get rich. Own a big home, own a nice car, rags to riches. I was born in rags, and now I have riches. The other version of the American dream, it seems to me, was Martin Luther King Jr.'s vision of the beloved community. And the beloved community is a community that's creative and compassionate and fair, and we would add ecologically healthy, and then we would add with no one left behind. So creative, compassionate, equitable, participatory, with no one left behind. And years ago, Hubert Humphrey had a really nice metaphor for saying this. He said that the sign of good government is not how rich are the rich, but does it take care of people in the shadows of life, at the dawn of life, and at the twilight of life? Does it take care of people who feel like they live in the margins, shadows of life? Does it take care of people, of old people, twilight of life? And does it take care of children, dawn of life? Well, I'm saying that that was Martin Luther King's vision. That was his hope. And I think today another prophetic witness of China to the West is, how about you too trying to be a society in which no one is left behind? And that's where it seems to me that Christianity and socialism really come together. How can you be Christian? How can I be Christian and want anybody left behind? So, hybridity, overcoming the worst aspects of individuality. I'm watching the clock. I said I was going to have six. I think I'm going to have... You know, if you go, when I go to China today, they'll always say, we're not a religious nation. Now, I know there are Christians in China. There are Buddhists in China, too. But in general, we're not a religious nation. The West is very religious, it looks to us like. Maybe that's a good thing. Tell us about it. There's curiosity. But I found myself with the Chinese saying, okay, I want to know what you mean by religion, and I'm going to ask you that. But it seems to me you have a kind of spirituality. So in a way, maybe you're an example of what in the West we call spiritual but not religious. Spiritually, you have some spiritual sensitivities, but you're not religiously affiliated. Now, you know how in the West there's many people that would define themselves that way, don't you? I bet there's one or two in this room. I'm spiritual but not religious. Well, I just want to say you have 1.2 billion companions. a lot of companions on the China side, people that find themselves with spirituality but not knowing what to do with questions of religious affiliation. What kind of spirituality do you have in China? I think part of it I've already said, that capacity to relativize yourself and give yourself to something more. All things considered, I think Chinese exemplify, and a lot of East Asians exemplify, what I would call a sense for the horizontal sacred. And let me explain what I mean. You know how sometimes when people say the sacred, they have God in mind? And they think of God, and I, by the way, I don't diminish this. This is part of my own piety. I believe in a God who's different from me, and I pray. And when I pray, I think there's someone listening. So I'm in favor of that. I'm not opposed to that. But I also recognize that you can have a sense of the sacred without that sense of God as a separate being. And when this really hit home to me was I was teaching a course, a really boring course, I thought was interesting, but everybody else thought it was pretty boring, called Contemporary Ideas of God. I taught it at Hendricks College. And I was so proud of the course. I had worked really hard in advance, and I had 16 ways of thinking about God, one a week. And students would come to the class, and there'd be the blackboard, and I'd draw diagrams. This is the first option. This is the second option. This is the third option. And half the class, you know, I'd be at the blackboard drawing. And at the end of the course, I was just bursting with pride, I'm afraid. And one of my favorite students came up to me, and she said, Dr. McDaniel, I really appreciate this course. And I said, oh, great. Why? And she said, because I realized I'm not interested in God anymore. Julie, you want to repeat that? She said, no, Dr. McDaniel, I'm interested in a spirituality of connectedness, not a spirituality of God. That's the way she put it. She said, I find spirituality in relationships with friends and family, and in relationships with the natural world. And you were spending so much time talking about something other and its properties that I think you lost a spirituality of connection. That's what she called it, a spirituality of connection. And as soon as I heard her say that, I thought, I think I know exactly what you mean. You're right. I spent so much time talking about God that God became a focal object in the imagination, somehow separate from the lived relationships with friends and family, with the natural world. So I coined the phrase the horizontal sacred, or you might call it, it's the sacrality of relationships between people and between people and the earth, whether they do or do not believe in God. They experience something sacred. That gave me new eyes for China, because what I was so sensing in some of my Chinese friends was they actually had a pretty deep sense of the horizontal sacred. They just didn't add to that something called belief in God, as they understood it. Well, that made me curious. I still go to China a lot, and I ask my Chinese friends now, would you like to believe in God? And actually, my experience is some of them say, yes, I would like to. If it made sense, I would like to. I've had some say, I actually need that. And they say, what would that add to your life that you don't already have with a sense of the horizontal sacred? Do you understand my question? Now, one student recently said to me, I think it would add hope. It's hard to live in China today. Jobs are very scarce. It's very competitive. There's a lot of anxiety. We are an anxious society, and I'm anxious about my own future. I sense that belief in God might provide me with a sense of hope when sometimes the circle seems a little closed with no exit. Well, I thought, you know, that makes sense, because that's actually what belief in God has meant for many people in biblical traditions. God is a source of fresh possibilities. Even in times of crisis, there's an opening, there's a fresh possibility, and one way we experience God is through the coming of fresh possibilities, moment by moment, year by year. A light at the end of the tunnel, hope. The student said one more thing. He said, I think that belief in God might give me a peaceful heart. It's a little different from hope, because hope is trying to get somewhere else, you know? But a peaceful heart is feeling a sense of peace wherever you are. You feel supported by something, loved by something, nourished by something. And you may have your relationships may be in tatters. You may not have hope. Is it still at some deep level okay? Is there a deep okayness? And I think the student was saying, I think if I believed in God, I might have a more peaceful heart, and I might have hope. And I felt, when that student said that, I felt, you know, we spend a lot of time overly theologizing things, but you're kind of going back to basics, aren't you? What difference would it really make to believe in God, however understood? Maybe that's it. Hope in a peaceful heart. And maybe that Chinese student, precisely knowing what he didn't have, was a prophetic witness for what can be had. Now, our problem today is that we've reduced God to a policeman in the sky, to a monarch. As Whitehead says, we've rendered unto God that which belongs to Caesar. So are there ways of understanding God that are deeper than that and provide hope and provide a peaceful heart? I think that's part of our invitation, and that's part of China's quest as well. And by the way, it's people like you who have planted the seeds for that kind of hope. All right, peace be with you. That's it.